United States v. Hearn. Mr. Maggard.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Joshua Maggard of Quarles & Brady, and I represent defendant appellant Mark Hearn in this pro bono appeal. Mr. Hearn was indicted on two counts of possession with intent to distribute. Count 1 carried a 235-month maximum sentence. Count 2 carried only a 33-month maximum sentence. The jury convicted Mr. Hearn of count 2, but acquitted him of count 1. This meant that he faced a 33-month maximum sentence. But there were two problems with the case below. First, to get any conviction, the government relied on inadmissible propensity evidence, and specifically an irrelevant decade-old prior conviction. Secondly, after the trial, the judge enhanced the sentence from 33 months to 210 months by relying on acquitted conduct. The effect of this was over a 14-year increase, a 536% higher, and six times the maximum of, that the Mr. Hearn's conviction allowed. Therefore, for these two reasons on appeal, Mr. Hearn requests this court to either reverse his conviction or remand for resentencing.
Just one question preliminary. How long was Hearn in prison for that 1995 conviction?
Your Honor, that's in the record. I believe it was about 3 years for his prior conviction.
Mr. Hearn ever been gainfully employed? Does the pre-sentence report give any indication of his background?
It does give the focus in the pre-sentence report was on his mental impairments.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to focus on. How I guess we didn't have a competency hearing here, but the suggestion is that we've got somebody pretty modest intellectual attainment.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. His IQ is estimated between 50 and 64, which yields a mental age of about 8.5.
That's what I was asking. How he got by in life? Did he live with someone or?
He did. He lived with a girlfriend, and he actually he has both a birth mother and an adopted mother. The birth mother is here with us today, and received support from both of these women. He did some small jobs as well. But we would, Your Honor, focus on precisely that. I mean, his mental image or his mental capabilities was something that the trial court specifically stated mitigated the crime. Yet he still chose in sentencing to sentence near the high end. With the first point regarding the inadmissible propensity evidence, this court should reverse. In 1995, Mr. Hearn admitted possession but denied intent. His defense was, well, yes, I was holding these drugs for someone else to distribute. In contrast, here his defense was that he never possessed these drugs. And the record is clear that these, according to his defense, were not his drugs. He was not aware because it wasn't his stuff. He didn't know the details because it wasn't his stuff. And in closing, Mr. Hearn's trial counsel stated, that's why Mark is so vague when he's responding to police questions, because he really doesn't know. And again, the trial court conceded that perhaps he didn't know the quantities. Thus, the 1995 conviction was not relevant. Now, as you see in the record, the trial court's understanding of the law is, this is the record at 90 at page 244, when the defendant is charged with a specific intent crime, evidence of past action is probative. Now, Your Honors, all of these drug charges are obviously going to be specific intent crimes, and the government conceitedly has to prove his intent. But the prior conviction was not relevant because here he never put his intent at issue. Instead, it was that possession was not his. And indeed, this court has expressly criticized the, quote, belief that a drug conviction always is relevant in any later drug prosecution. And again, in Beasley.
Lawyers say a number of things, trial lawyers say a number of things that suggested that he was putting intent into issue.
Your Honor, the record does reflect various arguments that were advanced, but I would submit the arguments that the government cites in its brief for this point, saying that he put his intent at issue. For example, the opening statement where he says, yes, he confessed, but there are perhaps other reasons for this. Maybe he was protecting somebody. And that he was not characterizing himself as a drug dealer. I mean, the point is that here the indictment was not for the fact that he was a drug dealer or wasn't. It was for these specific offenses, for these specific drugs, and he never admitted possession of these specific drugs. And indeed, the government pretrial notes at the record at 89 that, quote, if our only evidence of intent was this prior conviction, then that really is just propensity evidence. And so we would state that under this court's precedent in both Jones and Beasley, that the forbidden inference that this 95 conviction had to come in just because this was a specific intent crime is expressly rejected by this court.
What's the age of the defendant?
I apologize.
What's Mr. Hearn's age?
His current age? I believe he's over 40. Second, even if it is relevant, any probative value was outweighed by the substantial prejudice suffered by Mr. Hearn. Here it's no doubt that it was substantial prejudice, given the rather unique outcome. Mr. Hearn here was acquitted on the most serious charge. Now, there's a colorable argument that no conviction would have resulted absent this evidence. I noticed on an earlier panel, Your Honors asked the standard of harmless error and prejudicial error, and whether a reasonable jury would have acquitted without this evidence. And we would submit that here this is the case. The evidence was from some trash picks, but Mr. Hearn responded at trial that there were others in the house that were dealing these drugs, that had possessed these drugs. There was expert testimony regarding the baggies, and that this is how that drug dealers operate, is by cutting off corners of baggies. But again, Mr. Hearn's defense was that others had done that. In contrast to the previous case here, there were no fingerprints on Mr. Hearn's, none introduced at trial that showed that these drugs were his, that these baggies that he had handled. And so again, because it's essentially a concession that the evidence was improper and that 404B and 403 expressly prohibit this evidence. So because this conviction was based on inadmissible evidence, we would ask this court to reverse. And then secondly, the sentence imposed was both unconstitutional and unreasonable. In the first prong, it's unconstitutional because the consideration of acquitted conduct violates the Sixth Amendment. Now, admittedly, this court has taken the opposite view in both Horn and Price. And in both of those cases, this court reiterated the vitality of Watts in the post-Booker world. But Horn, which was this court's most recent pronouncement on this in 2007, is an interesting case because this court expressed some discomfort with its position on acquitted conduct. There it cited the 55-month increase in Horn as being considerable, and here there's a 177-month increase. Horn was an increase of less than half of the calculation for conviction, and here it's 10 times that amount. It's 536% increase. Most importantly, this court's expressly stated that Horn was not a case where the jury convicts of one minor crime and acquits of serious crimes, and then the judge bases his sentence almost entirely on that serious crime. That's precisely what occurred in the case below. Horn, therefore, stands for the proposition that some result must be so beyond the pale that consideration of acquitted conduct is per se unreasonable, and Hearn submits that this is that sentence and this is that case. I see in my rebuttal time, and I'd like to reserve.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Maggard. Ms. Duschman?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Meredith Duschman, and I represent the United States in this case. Your Honor, I want to just start with a question that you asked with regard to the competency issue or the diminished capacity issue. Early on in the case, the defense attorney, the trial attorney, he now has a new appellate counsel, said, well, gee, I think maybe his IQ is so low that I really feel more comfortable having a competency evaluation. Mr. Hearn had a very lengthy competency evaluation in which they were listening to his jail tapes, they observed him, this sort of thing, and I would urge the court to review the competency evaluation because one of the primary diagnoses in that was malingering, that Mr. Hearn was very much exaggerating his limitations. So I would urge the court, if the court has any concerns on that issue, to review the competency evaluation, the competency report, which will be part of the record.
So you don't accept this estimate is that his IQ falls between 50 and 64?
No.
Was that discussed in the sentencing hearing?
The competency evaluation and the results of the competency evaluation itself were not discussed. His competency / diminished capacity was discussed, and in fact, I introduced jail tapes, some of the same jail tapes that the...
Are you talking about the competency hearing or the sentencing hearing?
I'm talking about at the sentencing, but specifically with regard to... We didn't have a competency hearing because the competency evaluation came back and he conceded.
In the sentencing hearing, Judge Shabazz mentioned very briefly in a sentence... His cognitive limitations, but didn't resolve a dispute over what exactly his IQ is.
Correct. And I think for the court, the primary concern of the court at that time was the prior conviction. And the fact that the defendant was trying to basically do the exact same thing he did in the last case. He said in his prior, in 1995 conviction, gee, I wasn't really the drug dealer. I was taken advantage of. And quite frankly, I don't mean to be flip here, but the defense was, I'm too stupid to be a drug dealer. And that's exactly what the defense was here. And Judge Shabazz really took him to task with the fact...
I don't understand what that has to do with the length of the sentence.
Well, I think that they were trying to argue that...
I mean, you give the person seven times his sentence on the base of acquitted conduct. We've talked about the dog, the tail wagging
right.
the dog.
Right.
And what does the judge expect these people to say?
Well, I want to talk about the tail wagging the dog since you brought it up in the acquitted conduct.
Look, this business of... So Judge Shabazz, he didn't decide what this fellow's IQ is, but he seemed to think he had cognitive limitations, and he said that's a mitigating factor.
Absolutely. He recognized that.
Well, but where's the discussion of why it's mitigating and what weight it should be given in relation to the other factors? I mean, if you're going to sentence a person who's convicted for a crime, you know, give you 3 years, and instead you get, you know, 18 years, shouldn't the judge spend a little more time considering the appropriateness of the sentence than rather than getting angry at the person because of what he said years ago?
With Judge Shabazz did not sentence him to a vastly higher sentence because he didn't like his diminished capacity argument. He spent...
No, he was irritated with him because he thinks he's a wise guy.
He was.
You sentence a person to 15 more years for being a wise guy?
No.
Is that the post-Booker world?
Absolutely not. I wholeheartedly disagree with that. What the judge did in this case is... setting aside the Sixth Amendment issues for a minute with respect to acquitted conduct, I don't even think the court needs to get there in this particular case, because this is a case where the government isn't simply relying on a comparatively lower standard of proof between trial and sentencing to get him this higher sentence by counting all of this crack. There is a way here to reconcile the jury's not guilty verdict on the crack count and the fact that it should still be counted against him under traditional relevant conduct standards. When the court has to determine relevant conduct here on count two, which was the possession with intent to distribute cocaine, powder cocaine, the court had to use the amount of powder cocaine and any other drugs which were part of the same scheme or plan. The crack cocaine and the powder cocaine were in the same apartment on the same day. At trial, Mr. Hearn admitted that perhaps he may have known some drugs were in the apartment, but he didn't know how much or what type because they didn't actually belong to him. He argued that he falsely confessed to being a drug dealer to protect the real drug dealer. But, importantly, by sentencing, he came out and said, well, no, the drugs didn't belong to me, but he conceded, quote, "We're not indicating that he did not understand that large quantities of drugs and money were in the home. We believe that other people involved were probably the ringleaders. At most, Mark was a dupe who allowed his friends to use his and Sabrina's home to store materials." Even taking his argument as true, that the crack cocaine didn't belong to him, it's still a concession that the relevant conduct is there, because it's still part of the same scheme or plan. He knew the crack was in the house, and he was allowing somebody else, the real drug dealer, to store it, and he was hiding it, and then he even confessed, according to him, to protect the real drug dealer. So the crack is part of the same scheme or plan as the plan to store the powdered cocaine with intent to distribute that was in the house on the same day that he was convicted of. So the jury may have found that Hearn was not the one that possessed the crack cocaine with intent to distribute, but by his own admission, by sentencing, he knew it was there, and he helped hide it, and he helped the real drug dealer by falsely confessing.
You mentioned that the competency issue earlier, mm-hmm. a few moments ago. Is it the government's position that the malingering assessment masks this low number on the IQ, and that in fact it's higher?
Yes. Listen, don't get me wrong.
How do we get that number, by the way? Who made that assessment?
Well, Mr. Hearn has been in special education programs for most of his life. He's been getting Social Security disability because he purportedly has this low IQ. But when you review the competency evaluation, a lot of the basis of how these sort of generalizations about his intellectual capacity are now proven to be false. For example, he asserts that he can't drive. Well, he was arrested driving a vehicle.
The question was simply, yeah. what are the derivation of these numbers?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, for all we know, I mean, he obviously people with an IQ even of 50 have certain capacities.
Absolutely.
So maybe he pretended to lack even those capacities.
Absolutely.
But maybe he does have just an IQ of 50.
Well, I'm not up here to say that Mr. Hearn is a genius by any stretch.
No. Are you saying his IQ is above 50?
I don't know what his real IQ is.
He may have an IQ of 50.
That's possible, yeah. Yes.
Well, it would be nice if Judge Shabazz had said, you know, this guy, he's almost feeble. He had an IQ of 50, but nevertheless, you know, I think he should go away for 18 years. Maybe he could treat it as aggravating. Person this low mentation, maybe he can't be deterred. So.
Well, again, I don't think that Judge Shabazz here sentenced him to this sentence because he didn't like his...
attack on 15 years on the basis of acquitted conduct.
Well, no, I don't think it was one page.
Two pages of transcript to explain?
I think it was quite a bit more than that. We had actually a pretty lengthy discussion at sentencing, as I recall, about not only the relevant conduct issue.
I have just looked at the excerpt in the...
Right, and the appendix is missing pages of the sentencing
transcript. Well,
if you
didn't think this was adequate, you could have put it in your own appendix, right?
That's true. I could have done a supplemental appendix.
We were entitled to assume that you regarded the excerpt in the appellant's brief as an adequate picture of Judge Shabazz's sentencing, right?
I believe that.
They challenge the sentence. They put in what they think is relevant. If you think it gives a misleading impression, you should say it gives a misleading impression.
I don't think that the appendix is misleading in the sense, except for that it's just missing a couple pages.
Well,
did you say
in your brief it's missing a couple of pages, and here are the couple of pages?
No, I cited from the appendix and believe...
it's incomplete?
No.
No?
No.
But now you're saying it's incomplete and misleading.
No, I'm only responding to the court's argument by the virtue of how much pages a sentencing transcript takes up is
how... Well, if you think it's material, if you think the other pages contain material stuff, you should have told us.
I think that what's in the appendix is plenty to find that the court didn't err in its findings.
Okay. Well,
thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dushman. Mr. Maggard, how much time does he have? 3 minutes.
May it please the court, I'll be very brief and just focus on two responses. First, I believe the government's response to the questions from the panel about this acquitted conduct is just a microcosm of what's wrong with the current system and is what this court expressed in 2007 in Horn. This is a very special subset of relevant conduct. It's acquitted conduct. And so relying on things that were actually introduced to the jury, that the jury considered after the government had it shot and expressly rejected from the granted a higher standard of proof, to bring that in as part of the pattern of same conduct on a three-year sentence, it illustrates what's exactly wrong with this situation. And these were the concerns that were expressed in Horn with much gentler facts with the 55-month increase, whereas here we have 177. I mean, this is acquitted conduct is effectively giving the prosecution two bites at the apple. It's a jury of his peers has acquitted him on conduct, and it's coming back before the judge, and he's bringing it in and giving, frankly, a sentence that is unjustifiable. He's sentenced to over 17 years after being convicted for a three-year sentence. And then the second point, just briefly regarding his mental capabilities, these were based on psychiatric evaluations that had gone over a period of several years. They dated back to his elementary school, and then throughout also while he was on trial after he had been convicted of this. And this is all in the pre-sentence investigation report. This was all done at the instigation of the government. I mean, these documents were provided by them. And the quotes, he has significant sub-average levels of cognitive processing functions, academic achievement, sensory motor intervention functions, and adaptive behavior and social development. I mean, this is a gentleman that conceitedly has a low IQ. For Judge Shabazz to realize that, to state on the record that this is a mitigating factor, and then not only to enhance the sentence by even considering this acquitted conduct, but to intentionally sentence near the high end, is something that we would ask this court simply to reverse. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And Mr. Maggard, you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. We thank Ms. Dushman as well.